When interest rates finally go up in America, don't expect them to skyrocket. From APM, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update coming to you from Philadelphia today. Depending on your time zone, either just before lunch or just after lunch today, we'll hear from the guardians of interest rates at the Federal Reserve. Their briefing on the economy might contain vague hints about when interest rates will rise. Many a Wednesday, we check in with economist David Kelly, the chief global strategist at JP Morgan Funds.
Yeah, I think Chair Yellen will be smiling today. I think their assessment of the U.S. economy is going to get upgraded on multiple fronts. The job picture is looking better. Consumers are looking better. We've had a big pickup in retail sales and vehicle sales. Home building is doing very well. They will have to reduce their assessment of GDP growth for this year just because of the weakness in the first quarter. But overall, I think it's going to be a more positive assessment, and I think that's going to firm expectations that they will finally raise rates in September.
So September, the leaves will be turning, the nights will be getting more crisp, and perhaps after, what, 9 years, right, interest rates will go up.
You have to go back to June of 2006 for the last time the Federal Reserve actually raised interest rates, so it's a long time.
And it'll be huge hikes overnight. Is that what you're saying?
No. This is of all the Federal Reserves in the last 100 years, this is about the most dovish bunch we've ever seen. They will take it very easily. And in fact, what a lot of people think is they will raise rates once, and then they'll wait a meeting, at least one meeting, to see what happens, and then maybe raise rates again. But they are being very slow and cautious about how they approach this.
All right. David Kelly at JP Morgan Funds. Thank you for this.
Anytime.
Undocumented workers in the Dominican Republic face a deadline of today to register with the government there or possibly face deportation. The migrants are mainly from Haiti, and authorities say about half the 524,000 non-citizens have yet to be signed up. There's a long, difficult history for the two countries that share the island of Hispaniola in the Caribbean, and economic tensions are part of this. Eduardo Gamarra is a political science professor at Florida International University and has advised both the Dominican and Haitian governments. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Give us a sense of why the Dominican Republic moved to register its migrants in this way. I mean, of course, mainly people from Haiti.
Well, there's two reasons. One is really historical, the long pattern of basically giving and taking on both sides. The Dominican Republic celebrates independence not from Spain, not from a European power, but actually from Haiti. And so in many ways, the definition of what constitutes Dominicanness is really defined by being non-Haitian. And by the same token, of course, being Haitian is defined by the memory of having a single island united, and the notion that, you know, that Haiti governed all the island and not just the poorer side. So that's part one. And part two, it really is, and I think the story must be framed in the context of contemporary immigration debates that are going on all over the world. And certainly it's very, very reminiscent of the debate about immigration that's going on in the United States.
There's large immigrant populations who supply very often cheaper labor, but have established ties here, and it's hard to change those patterns.
The poorer country that exports an unskilled labor force that is basically in the host country performing most jobs that the native population no longer is willing to perform. And now, of course, they're moving into areas that are a little bit more specialized, such as tourism. So it's not that they're just now not an invisible population, but now it's a significant population with descendants who have been born in the Dominican Republic and who are, of course, demanding rights of citizenship. And that's where the debate is. The issue, of course, is there that it has become legitimized via not only a constitutional amendment, but via a ruling by the judicial review branch called the Constitutional Tribunal.
Eduardo Gamarra recently organized the Quisqueya Conference involving business people from both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. He's a poli-sci professor at Florida International University. Professor, thank you.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, counts twice, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Donate at marketplace.org by June 30th. Fitbit, the company that makes electronic bracelets that track your walking, running, and general gadding about in the name of fitness, plans to trade its stock on public markets for the first time tomorrow. This initial public offering is a watershed moment for wearable electronics. Tim Fitzsimmons has more.
You might think that the world of wearable technology will be dominated by the Apple Watch, but Fitbit isn't trying to be the everything computer for your wrist.
What they really are is sort of small cheerleaders that you wear in your wrist. And there are certain people in the population for whom these products are incredibly great medicine.
That's Dan Ledger, a principal with Endeavor Partners. He sees the demand for fitness trackers like Fitbit, devices that count your steps, measure your heartbeat, and even motivate you to get off your butt and exercise, should have a lasting appeal. He says Fitbit has become known because of their retail strategy.
Big box, pharmacies, sporting goods, wellness, they have a far greater retail presence than any other consumer wearable device in the market today.
Matthew Wong is an analyst at CB Insights. He says Fitbit's IPO and high valuation represent a win for the company's early venture investors. But once it's publicly traded, other investors will want to know its plans for growing the market for activity trackers. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
And charitable giving in the U.S. has finally risen above pre-recession levels. Giving USA, which tracks this, says people gave an estimated $358 billion to charity last year, the highest in 7 years. That's about $47 billion more than they gave in 2007, the previous peak. Donations to houses of worship are down as congregations shrink in some places and people choose to make donations to a wider variety of causes. From WHYY in Philadelphia today, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.